I have, I've never really believed in mass evangelism. Now, I've been saying this for years to myself. I didn't say it because I didn't know anything about it, but that's usually when you say it. It's harder and harder for me to say this since I've gotten tangled up with Billy Graham. My wife also has been pretty cynical about this, and we went to Dallas about 8 years ago, and a man introduced me, a mutual friend, Howard Butt from Texas, introduced me to Billy, and we sat next to each other at dinner, and he said, Keith Miller is interested in small groups. And Billy was very kind and looked at me, and I think he thought I meant a group about like this. But my wife, who was very cynical about mass evangelism, went to the meeting with me that night and made a public profession of faith. I do have something to blame Billy for, and he said I could really be honest up here under Christ if this is what I was led to do. One of my children has picked up, because of going forward in one of your movies, 2 four-letter words. And I don't think she'll ever get rid of them. And I must be honest to tell you this. These words are love and hope. And we're very grateful to you, Billy, for what you mean in our family. And this week I came here with a lot of ambivalence because I've never been an evangelist, which, if it is not already obvious to you, will be soon. I never even got the hand signal book, which I... which I'm sure is a secret document, but I know Billy wrote it. Billy has just amazed me. I'm very interested in communication. I've never been any place. I wonder if in America there has ever been under one roof as many talented and gifted people who love Christ, who can communicate persuasively the gospel of Jesus Christ, as there may be in this room tonight. And this is an exciting thing historically to me. And it just scares the tar out of me. I remember coming in here last night, and I'm an Episcopal layman. Either one of these is bad enough in this crowd. But I was sitting up there in back, and Billy came out. He gave 2 announcements, and he fouled up one of them about the seminars. He gave a short word of welcome, and 3 Episcopalians tried to come forward. I'd like to tell you what I've seen happening this week, because I'm a witness to you. Monday night, Dr. Hoffman hit an anvil, and it grated on my nerves at first. The anvil said, as he hit the anvil, he said, this meeting will be about committing your life to Jesus Christ and about going with him. And then he said it again in another way, and in another way. And somehow, sitting back there secretly, I wouldn't have said this to anybody, but I was disappointed. Not in his presentation. He's magnificent. And I couldn't have disagreed with anything he said. But I had some other problems I wanted to deal with. I had an agenda, and God hadn't, neglected to talk to me about this one. But as this week has moved on, I am so glad that he struck that note. Because it's becoming the center of a strange living mosaic, which the various talks God seems to be making out of the various addresses I've heard so far. Leighton Ford began by pointing out to us, by painting us, a moving picture of an age in which we must change not the message, but our pattern of ministry. And he showed us a revolutionary atmosphere, as he can do very quickly and deftly. And then last night, Tom Skinner did a thing I've never seen done before. He brought a revolution into this room. A powerful and loving one, and at least one evangelical money changer was chasing his spiritual nickels all over the floor of the auditorium after that. After the meeting, I don't know whether it was 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000. As I say, I'm an Episcopalian, and after you get over 125, we get so excited we can't count it. This place was half full of people who wanted to come and talk about the problem of being Christ's people across some lines. But there was one question which kept coming from the floor to the stage, a frustrated question. People said three or four times in different ways, what must we do? Tell us, what must we do? And as I sat up here listening to this, and the people on the stage were patiently trying to give us answers, I couldn't help thinking of Dr. Walter Hearn, the biochemist, who's a very sharp lay speaker. And he had just given a talk several years ago on how to go out and witness right now. And one of the little, you know, the little pink and white ladies, you may not have them in your church, the little pink and white ladies who sit on the front row in your church, and you know, she came up just, she always there every Sunday, and she came rushing up to this sophisticated Dr. Hearn and said, "Oh, Dr. Hearn," she said, "my cup runneth over. What must I do?" Dr. Hearn looked at her and he said, "Well, madam, why don't you go slosh it on someone?" And in various ways, this was the answer which came back. But the men from the stage, as patient as they were, I sensed they were frustrated with us. "You really don't understand," I heard them say underneath their answers. And behind those answers, I heard a common theme. "We don't want to participate with you in another program, even a great one. We want to live with you an open style of life in which color will soon not even be relevant to our commonness. But only our mutual problems in living and working in Christ's overgrown vineyard in a crazy and mixed up world." And last night, a bunch of us wanted to go out after that and tell our churches. This morning, fortunately, God sent Dr. Reese to us to remind us that his servant Ezekiel sat for 7 days watching and listening and identifying before he jumped up and did any counseling at all. And those of you who want to rush home and do something about this, let me tell you, we're in a majority here who feel this way, at least we were last night. And at home, you'll be in a minority. And I want to talk about this tonight, what might happen to you. And he said that to approach this great outer task that God had given Ezekiel, that he first had to go into an inner pilgrimage with God and get close to him. And then my dear friend Ken Chafin, who followed him, said that until we walk out in the world and face to face, starkly, the threat of change, and he spelled it out in no uncertain terms, we'll never have a need strong enough spiritually to drive us back in the closet, to have an inner journey with Jesus Christ, which will give us the power we'll need to risk and to live a vulnerable life in the world. Now, I'd like to pick up at this point and talk to you about, the topic I've been assigned to talk on is communication from the inner pilgrimage, from the inner journey. Because I think there's more to the inner journey than just prayer. We've always said the inner journey is the journey of prayer and the outer one is of action. I think there's a power of communication through the inner pilgrimage that brushes aside defenses and goes through color and goes into the heart. And I believe if some of us can learn to live a vulnerable, life-sized life, we can be brothers with a minimum of Mickey Mouse. I got to stop a minute because I'm really hot. We spent 4 hours last night talking about getting the gospel out on the street. We've, a few minutes ago, threw out the man who looks more like Jesus Christ than anybody in the auditorium. But it would have been a messy hour if I hadn't told you that. You see, I think one of the things that, good gosh, folks, we're talking about a walking gospel.
You know, those kids didn't do a thing but sit down there, and you know, they might have come to hear about Jesus Christ. Now please, I don't want to blame these ushers. This is what we've always done. And it was a reaction as kindness to those of us up here. But that just shows how twisted off we are in our whole structure. Now, please, I didn't come to do this, and Lord knows I don't want it. I want you to like it. You know, I got enough problems inside. And I would like to talk to you tonight, though. I'd like to continue, because this is exactly, unfortunately, this was the topic of my talk. God sent me two examples, and I've lost them, and I hope we can get them back, but we've chased them, and we'll see. Hebrews 1:1 is my text, and I'm piggybacking on Dr. Hoffman and several others over the time. When in former times God spoke to our forefathers, he spoke in fragmentary and varied fashion through the prophets. But the author goes on to say that in Jesus Christ, God has opened the door to his chest and showed us his inner heart, his hopes and dreams and plan for the redemption and fulfillment of human life. He has showed us something of his own dream for an inner pilgrimage with each one of us. Every generation seems to experience at least one central, pervasive human problem that's invisible, like the Spirit, blowing through a generation. And this problem, I think, colors at least everything. I think it covers everything it touches. And around this problem clusters many of the more obvious social dilemmas we've been talking about, which are really, in my opinion, only symptoms of this central, deep, snaky problem that goes underground through a generation. And great renewal has taken place historically in the church when the church has begun to see the way the healing gospel of Jesus Christ is speaking specifically to that generation's problem as it's experienced by the common man. But if this is true, how in the world would one go about finding our generation's pervasive human problem in the midst of the thousands of cries for help from all around us and for attention? During the past 10 years, I have collected almost 4,000 anonymous questions from lay leaders, ministers, and their wives. In large meetings like this, in small retreats, after we've begun to feel safe with each other a little, we pass out slips of paper. And to ensure safety for the people, the questions are anonymous. Everybody has to write. You can't cop out by not writing. You have to write, "I think this is a stupid procedure," if you don't want to write a question. And then fold it and turn it in. The question was, what is the most pressing personal problem that keeps you from living close to Jesus Christ in your own life where no one sees you? Now, this can be anything, I would tell them, and it is anything. Anything among ministers and laymen, these are church leaders all, from disbelief in the Trinity to masturbation. And you'll be amazed at the percentages of everything between. A while back, I correlated a random 1,000 of these questions and discovered that approximately 0.5% I know that you probably came to hear the music, but I came 1,000 miles to talk to you, so, you know, kind of stay cool, will you? Stay with me. What I'm talking about is how phony we are inside. You'll pick it up real fast. A while back, I correlated around a random 1,000 of these questions and discovered that approximately 0.5% of the problems could be considered in any real sense technically theological. And yet at that same time, of the materials I examined in terms of sermons and Sunday school materials, 90% of the material was aimed at an interest with these same people that concerned them deeply, less than 1%. I am not suggesting the replacing of theological sermons or teaching, for goodness sake, but only the fact that people's crying needs are often being ignored in our own communication with them too. I write to these questions. And this is evidence to me that there's a need. Now,
But out of your non-Christian marketplace, the situation is just as bad. I mean, your bank's just as funny as our bank. The world's communication media seems to be accentuating the common man's inner problems. All of it. Because of the skill and pervasiveness of modern advertising in America, particularly on TV, we know more about each other's homes and personal habits than any generation in history has. I know approximately what kind of cereal you eat. I know what you serve with. I know what you wear in every room in your house. I bet I could line 10 of you women up here whom I've never met and describe your underwear fairly accurately. I've seen it all on TV. We have created a fantastic illusion of intimacy and freedom. But along with this illusion of honesty has come a strong drive to look neat and cool, adequate in all circumstances. Kids and the rest of us learn from the most beautiful models in the world how to hide our true feelings if they might be considered unattractive or inadequate. And apparently we'll buy anything that promises adequacy or appearance. Look at it. There seems to be only one area in my own life which TV is not penetrating. And that's inside my mind, behind this facade, this mask that I'm showing you. In here, on the inward journey, I'm alone and uncertain about me, and about you, and about how you feel about me. And yet I'm committed to Jesus Christ as much as I possibly can be. And since we all know how to appear happy and well-adjusted, from the time we can sit in front of the tube, any restless sense of incompleteness or loneliness that I feel is even more poignant. And I think that this deeply personal, restless incompleteness is near the root of our generation's major pervasive human problem of depersonalization. But strangely, the problem is almost worse for us committed Christians, because we are subtly trained that if we are restless or lonely, it may be a reflection on the depth of our commitment. Or if we express such feelings, non-Christians might not want our faith. So this kind of honesty would hurt our witness to Christ, is the way the line goes. So of all our generation, we evangelicals are sometimes the most frustrated and lonely with our problems of the inner pilgrimage. This restless, lonely, and sometimes frightening sense of unfulfillment finds all the age group, all the divisions of our day. The young people feel it acutely, and are rebelling like crazy, reaching all directions for the personal. The state of the old people, who feel they're demanding security, and feel shunted aside, and being impersonalized. Men feel it and rush after sex and power, and so do women. Rich people feel it, and poor people feel the creeping impersonal in their lives, the threatens to squeeze them against the wall and squash them like a bug and no one will ever know. The challenge of identity, Tom spoke of last night. And the black man is deadly serious, as I think we can see, to earn this depersonalization, which he seems to think, however, is unique to his experience in our time, even though it's 1,000 times worse because of what Tom called his high visibility. But if this is true, then that the issue of restless unfulfillment within our lives, how does one begin to communicate the gospel with integrity in a way that can be heard by a restless generation that's shifting so much they don't stand still and they seldom come to meetings like this? The church's answer has often been proximity, fellowship, get with them, involvement, and then preach the gospel. But somehow it isn't working, even as it once did. Real fellowship, which is personal, cannot, it seems, as Tom told us last night, be pilgrim in the basement for too late. If restless, lonely incompleteness is the disease, then I believe the answer will have to have built into it restless, lonely incompleteness, just as a serum has to have something of the essence of the disease in it. If the problem is deeply personal, then the answer must be not fellowship, but something deeply personal. But how in the world do we who have been trained to look victorious learn to bring our own inner problems into the communication of the gospel of Jesus Christ in a healthy, creative way. It's against everything we've been saying. Well, I've heard many ministers say from the pulpit, please excuse the personal illustration. Lucky God didn't feel that way, he wouldn't even have Jesus Christ. And yet, you all, I understand this reticence. I've been trained to look successful and happy and not to talk about myself. It's culturally not considered good taste. But inside, from the time I was a little boy, I've often been very anxious. I've been somehow lonely and had terrific feelings of inadequacy. I worried about what people thought of me, and if you were small enough, I'd hit you if you accused me of it. I deny that I cared at all. I've often been anxious about the future for my own self and for my children. I've been frustrated in many of my closest relationships. And I still almost desperately avoid failure. And the rest of you out there in the world appear to be so self-assured that when Jesus Christ became more than a word to me, and I saw that here was something real, and tried to commit my life to him, I began to talk to you about him. And I tried to communicate with the self-assured people I saw. And virtually nothing happened that lasted. I would sigh inwardly and go on alone, aching for someone to hear the song that I heard in my inner pilgrimage and to love what they heard the way I loved it. I looked for books. I looked all over for books. It would help me in the strange contradictions in my real life behind the facade and my inability to move people toward the God I was beginning to know and love in Jesus Christ. And I poured over the scriptures. You know that only a few Christian writers in all of history seem to reveal their own inner contradictions so that I could study them and identify with them. And you know who these men were? It amazed me. We have done something, we have had selective blindness psychologically. We've done this with the scriptures. We don't read the Bible. We read what the speakers tell us is in the Bible, and we go back and look and say, sure enough. And according to the Protestant Reformation, the Holy Spirit is to be the preacher. We're leading in often another century theology. And now many women are being reborn, being checked out, being started out, who've never known about all the things they're supposed to see in the Bible, and they're seeing a new bunch of things. And this is the way the new happens. But two of these men are Paul and Augustine, who were very Christian. And I've always thought of them as theologians. Do you realize that Paul may have been one of the first men in history and antiquity to open himself in a personal way in his speaking and writing? He was awful, according to our standards for preachers. He bragged. He said, I'm the best Jew that ever came down the pipe. Okay, loose translation. He said, best education, I got a summa cum laude degree from Wheaton. Best family? Well, what would you do if a minister started out like this? Not only that, he said, I'm the best Christian. If you don't know how to operate, look at me. To get on the street. Can you imagine that coming from a pulpit? And he said he had a lot of that to write it down. He told his followers in detail, great detail, about how he suffered. I suffered more than any of you. Whip, look at those stars. How many times? 39 times. You all know how many times. Put that coal in the water. Yeah. Oh, look at this guy. He got mad at Mark and said, you're not even good enough to follow me on the second missionary journey, stay home. He got mad at Peter and shooting out in front of his district superintendent for a gun in Galatia. Which is you. But you're now getting crucified for it. Paul was frustrated by his own inability to follow his preaching, and he told us so in writing. So much of the time he seems to have been talking about himself. But we don't read those passages that way now. Every time he got in trouble, what did he do? Did he give him an explanation about the cross? He started telling his personal testimony. I was a Pharisee of the Pharisees. He told the story of his own life. His favorite sin, what, 5 times? 4 or 5 times, I don't know. And yet everywhere this strange man went, men's lives were transformed through contact with him. And paradoxically, they became devoted to Christ and not Paul. Why, when it talked about himself so much, When Paul opened his inner life, what was there? The living Christ was there. The living Christ, when we committed Christians get bold enough to open our lives in a natural way, people see the living Christ at work healing and changing those lonely, miserable lives before their very eyes. In our witnesses, we sometimes bring out old problems, old dead ones, like old dead stuffed owls. You can see them coming. And hold it up for people to see. But everyone knows it's not dangerous, and everyone knows its eyes are glass and its feet are all wide. You know what Paul seems to have done? He seems to have opened the window and let a few fly through, feathers and all, live on, right in the meeting. And the people could watch God, the Holy Spirit, reaching out and touching some of those problems before their eyes. And that's pretty good evidence that he's alive. But we're terrified to open ourselves in this way, because only other people can see him in the brokenness of our circumstances. And in our lack of faith, we're afraid they'll only see the truth about us. And we can't risk it. Now, what I think we're actually doing, we laymen in ministry, we need to begin opening ourselves with our true needs and hopes and dreams for the rest of the world, because we're afraid to express our dreams as much as we are our problems, for fear they won't be fulfilled and then we will have failed. What we're doing when we do this is we're identifying with the problem instead of the answer. For years as a Christian, I have been trained. I do not know anyone who has not been trained to identify with the answer. I was trained in seminary and church. In all our planning meetings like this one, somehow we represented in our minds the answer to the world's problems. The question was, how could we get the indifferent people in the world to sit still so we could drop it on them? This loving truth. Now that's oversimplified, but they never would sit still. And they're still not. It was the late Richard Niebuhr who pointed out to me that Jesus Christ identified with the problem and not the answer. As a matter of fact, he identified so completely that the Sadducees could get away with mistaking him for the problem, a sinner, and crucifying him. But what do I mean, identify with the problem? It sounds like you're denying your commitment or your identification with Christ at first. One night several years ago, I was speaking to a group of laymen, and we were stumped at this point. This was a men's group. One man finally said, "Miller, we don't even know what you mean. Identify with the problem." I thought a minute and I said, "Okay, how many of you men will go out with me tonight to a red lighthouse to witness for Jesus Christ?" Right away I knew I should have said a roller rink. After a moment, a few hesitant hands went up. I turned to these men. "Okay," I said, "how many of you now would go without a Bible in your hand?" Because if we go with Bibles or prayer books or tracts always prominently displayed in our hands, they know we're really not coming into their world. We aren't in any true sense one of them in their loneliness and misery. They know we're only Christmas basket Christians, and that we won't even take the chance that people might think we're one of them. But ladies, if a man is seen going into a house of ill repute without a Bible in his hand, he might be mistaken for a customer. And all people know the risk of this kind of vulnerability when they see it. And it does something. Alcoholics Anonymous found out a long time ago that only those who admit they are still weak and powerless to handle alcohol on their own can really help other alcoholics find new lives with self-respect. And the street workers have found out that only those who share the lives of the ghettos, the smell of urine on rotting back steps, tenement steps, who walk through the same garbage in the streets, these are the people who are being effective in the ghettos and the Peace Corps and on and on. Those who become vulnerable enough to share the problems are those most likely to set men free from those problems. Jesus. I hope some of you will stay with me on this, because I know what it sounds like, and I'm sorry, it sounds so different because it's the coin flipped over. But Jesus Christ himself, you remember, thought it not too great to be vulnerable, to taste and reveal and feel and reveal to us the struggling problems of our own lives. Now, most people certainly don't think of Jesus Christ as one who talks about his own personal problems as a part of his ministry, but he did. He must have. As Bruce Lawson has pointed out, if Jesus didn't tell his disciples about the specific nature of his dilemmas, his own temptations in the wilderness, then how did they find them out to write them down?
No one was with him but Satan. And he probably wouldn't tell. Or on Gethsemane, where he sweated blood, he must have told them something of what happened and how tough it was and how hard and how the agony of it, even though it isn't recorded, because they were all asleep part of the time. In any case, here's a minister who shared his real life with his disciples, the pleasant and the unpleasant, and an identifying power was released through the Holy Spirit that we men can be unlocked and be freed to be the open, creative people God made us to be in healing touch with people and with Him and with our true selves. But how would one start? If you could believe me, how would you start? After years of being careful not to be open, to be open. Please don't go home and take off the mask. I mean, this is not what anyone's saying. You know, two ways to get in an egg. One's with a hammer, you know, and the other's by applying a little warmth. If you do it with a hammer, you go ripping your family's mask off, you know, you got to take that chicken to raise and you'll probably die. You apply a little warmth when the chicken gets out and run around by himself. And I think there's a great mistake in the sensitivity training of ripping off people's masks. And I'm not talking about that. But how would you start? Well, it happened to me in an unexpected way, totally to me. I made a commitment of my future to Christ. I said, God, but this time I was so out of it in my life, I had no hope, really. And I turned to Him, I just backed into Him and said, if you want anything in this stinking soul, take it. It was not much of a glorious commitment, but He took it. I began to pray and I began to read the scriptures, and I still do, every day. Some days I skip. When I get up in the... Well, see, a lot of you do too. When I get up in the morning, when I get up in the morning, they told me to say, Lord, I love You, every morning. And I did, whether I felt like it or not. One morning I got up and I felt terrible. I was tired of being good. I was sick of Christian meetings. I had smiled till my teeth were dry. And I said, very hesitantly, because I thought it might be my last remark, I said, God, I don't like You at all, and I wish You'd get off my back. I'd like to go to southern Mexico and have a runaway. I'll never forget the first time I ever said that was with a group of Baptist ladies, and the only question was, after I finished, said, Mr. Miller, what is a runaway? And from an old woman, I said, well, lady, if I had a runaway to southern Mexico, I would probably just, you know, get on a plane and go down there, and 30 minutes, first 30 minutes after I got there, I'd have a half a dozen margaritas. She said, oh, and no more questions for 2 days. And 2 days later, I found out they thought margaritas were girls. And I said, God, I don't like You at all. I wish You'd get off my back. And I lay there waiting for the lightning to strike. But You know, no lightning. And so I told her, hey, I don't want to feel this way, Lord. I really want to be Your boy. Help me not to feel this way about the church and Christianity. For the first time, I'd really leveled with God inside on the inner pilgrimage when I didn't feel good about Him. And a strange thing began to take place on my inner pilgrimage. I began to accept my true feelings, which I had pretended didn't exist. You know, and what kind of a relationship can you have with somebody when you're hiding your true feelings? And I began to offer them when I could now see them, because I wasn't repressing them. I began to be able to offer all these awful feelings for changing and shaping and forgiveness. I had never been forgiven. I'd never been able to accept it because I hadn't been able to be a sinner. And I began to find that I wanted, with a kind of growing excitement, to learn about this, because all my life I'd wanted to accept myself inside. And I began to see that, as Tom did last night, that the scriptures are filled with the ruggedness of actual life. They'd scare you to death if you read them without your evangelical glasses. Scare you to death. We have sweetened them beyond recognition. Jesus Christ talked about sex, drinking, and crooked business deals all the time. Read the parables again when you go home. I began to see that if we can only sweep away the accumulated sugar, He was talking about the restlessness of modern life in the inner pilgrimage, where there is no color, where there is no rich or poor, where there is no barrier at all. Out of this first honest and therefore desperately personal communication began to develop a new kind of personal relationship with God. I am convinced that honesty about oneself and personalness are highly correlated somehow. Now, I'm not talking about just honesty. When we start these honesty cults, I'm sick of them. That's honesty about you. You know, I say I don't like you, I've never liked you. See, that just makes you vulnerable. That's a good way for Christians to work off their hostility, which they've been repressing. I'm talking about vulnerable honesty about me is highly correlated with personalness. In fact, I'm convinced that we can only be personal to the extent that we can be honest. Think about it just a second. A personal friend is one with whom I can be most honest about myself and who still likes me. And when the church loses this vulnerable honesty from the pulpit and the Sunday school lectern and the deacons' meetings and in its prayers, then we're no longer personal in our congregations, and deep communication about the inner journey stops, and we cannot speak to the world in its agony anymore. And I think that's why this layman's movement has been so fantastic, because these people are beginning to tell what they're seeing and hearing inside. But so far, I've still only been honest with God in my own room. And then came a miracle. One day in a counseling situation, in order to identify with a man who was suffering from guilt like crazy, a Christian man, this inner honesty accidentally spilled over into my life with people. I told this guy I just couldn't leave him in his misery because I had the same problem. I told him that I had the same problem of jealousy and resentment he did that same morning. I thought he would walk out of my office in disgust. I'd really fouled it up. But instead, he just sat there looking at me. And in a minute, he said, "Are you serious?" And then I wished I hadn't said it. When I nodded my head, he began to weep, and he said, "Oh, thank you." He said, "If you've got this problem and you're able to keep going and you're a committed Christian, maybe I can one more day. I've been so lonely. Nobody else has ever had my problem." And I became the priest Paul Reese talked about this morning, who had a revival in a leprosarium when it turned out that people began to realize that he also had leprosy. The leprosy of being full of myself as a committed Christian. And I began to experience a whole new dimension of communication and relatedness with people and with God, all kinds of people, because black people and white people, if you've got a wife, you know, and you all fuss, and you've got kids you're worried about, what difference does it make what color you are? Suddenly we've got the commonnesses in our agony and not, you see, in our humanness and not in our success, our attempts at divinity. And we're trying to get together up here on this level, and our commonness is what breaks through all the bounds. I can cry about a black child, and so can you, or a white one. I had joined the men and women Christ lived with and came to heal those who know they need a physician. And all it's cost me is my reputation with some of you Christians who don't have any problem. How does this openness lead Christians out in the world, though? The thing we've been talking about here, and I'm getting close to the end of this, but how does it lead us out into the world to become vulnerable, involved with Christ and the social agony around us, if this hypothesis is true? Now, I don't know any rules for this, and it's very experimental with us the last few years with a bunch of us in a group. But some of us started a small group at 6:30 in the morning to begin to find out how to learn in a safe atmosphere where nobody would hurt anybody else about how to communicate about the inner journey where we'd been alone so long in our faith. Now, this wasn't an honesty cult. It wasn't a place to confess your latest sin. I've been in groups where if you haven't committed adultery the last week, you know, you feel like a piker. It's not competitive sinning, which people think it is. It's a place in which, nor is it a place, a pietistic clique, a pit, you know, where we just get together and kind of have warmth by rubbing each other together spiritually like sticks, the Boy Scout method. You know, it's not that kind of deal either. It's a place where you begin facing openly the troubles and problems we have in living, working, and praying with our families, with our jobs, with our cities, and being Christ's people and doing His will. And we tried to help each other do what we were talking about last night, to go out in the community and see where the problems were. We didn't even know what the problem was. We tried to find out what each guy's ministry might look like as a layman as he moved out into the community. Had a couple of ministers in our group. And as we began to share this inward journey with Christ and with each other, some of us started being led beyond our own horizons into these scary places Ken was talking about in ways we could never have anticipated. And I'd like to end these remarks with one example of the way this has worked with one man in our group. His name is Walter. He's a successful home builder and real estate developer in our part of the country. Walter spent his youth in an orphan's home, though,
And he knows what it's like not to have anything. Now, he made a commitment of his life to Christ a few years ago, and he had the advantage of never having gone to church. So he didn't have to relearn. He just had to learn to live. Now, I really was being facetious then, but, kind of halfway, because that's that hostility that just bubbles up a little. I'm in the church, and I'm not one of these outside guys looking in. I teach a Sunday school class, and I make it home on Sundays just every Sunday I can. So I'm not talking like that. But we're the church, and I'm pretty sarcastic about myself. He made a commitment in his life a few years ago, and this guy would, you might say this guy lived a free life before. And he began to learn to live. One morning, Walter came into the group, and he was very thoughtful. He said, "Hey, you guys, I woke up at 4 o'clock this morning. I have his permission to tell you this. And I couldn't go back to sleep. I was praying, and I discovered an amazing thing." He's an old Southern boy, and he said, "I love niggers." And he didn't, having been raised in the South, he didn't see anything in Congress about what he was saying, besides he was crying. He said, "Listen, man, if I love him, though, I guess God would want me to do something about him, wouldn't he?" And we said, "Let us pray." No, we didn't. We said, "We suppose so." He said, "I'd like you to pray for me that I'll know what I can do to help Christ with the race situation." And then he adds something we seldom add here in our town. And we did pray that. And the next week, this crazy guy came to the meeting, very excited but very uncertain. He said, "Listen, they've asked me to serve on the Human Relations Committee." He said, "You want me to come out for a statement in favor of open housing?" And he said, "I went around to all the realtors in town the next day, and none of them would go along." They said, "We think you ought to, though, Walter. Be good for you." So I checked the National Realtor Study and found out that in the price range of my homes, if a black family moves in the neighborhood, the surrounding property goes down about 45% in the South. And he stopped a minute. He said, "Hey, you guys, what I found out was that if I take this stand on open housing, it might ruin me financially. Let us pray." Well, we're playing with real bullets now. And he was just sharing his inner pilgrimage. And we wrestled with Walter on this problem and finally told him, "Look, we found out that, these guys wanted him to go out and make this. There were 4 ministers on the thing and a couple other guys, some social workers. And they wanted him to make this statement." I said, "Hey, does anybody else on the committee have any property?" He said, "Not a stick." I said, "Seems to me you got a different decision, Walter." And I said, whatever you do, our advice to him was, don't do it out of guilt. Do it because you feel like Christ is leading you to do it. The following week, the whole business came to a head. Walter said he'd been looking at into the problem and praying about what to do when he remembered a story Elton Trueblood had told our group the week before this thing started. It was a story about that crazy guy, who had the notion he wanted to push a wheelbarrow across Niagara Falls, on a tightrope with a man in it. And he set up 2 poles in his backyard and he started to practice. And he stretched the rope between them and first with a balance bar and then without it. Then with a wheelbarrow, and he could run that thing back and forth. And finally, he added 175 pounds of bricks and it never fell off the wire. His next-door neighbor started watching every evening, and the crowds got bigger and bigger, and the press picked it up as the time drew near. And a huge throng was on hand when they got out there. It's a clear day. Just a little wind blowing that wire. And the fellow looked a little nervous as he stood looking at the wire finally at the time had come. And he turned to his faithful buddy, his neighbor Joe, and he said, "Hey, Joe, you believe I can make it?" And Joe looked at him and slapped him on the back and said, "Buddy, I absolutely believe you can make it. I bet a tenth of this year's income on it, $1,000. And the old boy looked back across the falls and said, "Joe, do you really believe?" And Joe said, "Seriously, I really believe." He said, "Great, you're my man. Get in the wheelbarrow." Then Walter that morning said quietly to the rest of us in the group, "This week the Lord said to me, Walter, if you trust me with your future, get in a wheelbarrow on this race thing." And I did. Now, this is not a happy ending story, as evangelical stories are supposed to be. I talked to Walter. I was out of town a long time. When I came back, it was about a year before I asked him about it, and I said, "Walter, how'd that deal go on the race thing?" I said, "Did that cost you anything?" Kind of kidding him, He said, "Well, it cost me $100,000 last year, and we don't know how much more it's going to cost him." He went to the Chamber of Commerce, which he belonged to strictly on his ability. He had never had his social standing because he was one of the old families, just because he was a sharp guy. And he went down there and he said, "Look, you guys, let's come out with a race statement that matches the national one. It won't be giving them a thing, but it'll let them know we're thinking. We're trying." And it died for lack of a second. And so he said, "Okay, look," he was kind of embarrassed because he stammers and he
didn't know what to tell him. He said, all right, look, he said, I have a motion that we have a committee to study doing it. He died for lack of a second. Total rejection. I prayed with him the next morning. He was just about to cry. Grown man. And it cost him $100,000. Been rejected by the group he wanted to be his peers. And then I said, anything else happen? He said, yeah. He said, we got some folks in. He said, it was great. He said, but you know, he said, the last family we tried to get in, he said, we had a problem with. He said, money tightened up. You know, the money situation had been going like this a couple of years. Money tightened up, and the guy couldn't get his loan. And he thought Walter was trying to keep him from moving in that neighborhood. And the loan people said, we're just not going to do it. Your situation's not so that we can. So Walter went down, didn't tell the man, but he wanted him to have that home for his family. Had a bunch of little kids, and he was a nice guy, professional man. And, you know, the fact is that he would have been the kind of situation which would really help the black-white relationship in that neighborhood. So Walter went down with nobody knowing about it, and he went down to this loan association, and he said, look, he said, give the guy the money. He said, we can't, Walter. He doesn't fit the picture right now. We just can't do it. Walter said, I'll co-sign for $25,000, this $25,000 note. And Walter wouldn't have done that for his brother a year ago. Because if the guy didn't pay, Walter was stuck for $25,000. And when he got back to his office, he was feeling, you know, kind of good about it, but kind of scared. And the telephone rang, and it was the Race Relations Committee. And they said, hey, Walter, I hate to tell you, but a guy just turned you in for being a racist. Some guy that's trying to build a house in your neighborhood, he says you're trying to keep him from getting the finance money. And I said, what did you think, Walter? He said, I thought that black bastard. I said, well, what do you think now? He said, well, I prayed about it. He said, you know what I found out, what the Lord taught me? He said, we've screwed these people for so long, they can't possibly believe us. He said, we've got a real job on our hands of living with them and loving them and teaching them how to accept things. They don't even know how to take things when they're offered. Now, something happened about that time to some of us who watched this man struggle in his inner pilgrimage. Two ministers in the group have a big downtown church. They gave the educational wing for a Head Start program for the downtown kids. It didn't make any difference whether they're black or white. Suddenly something happened to the guy. And there's a free medical clinic in that same church being run by an interdenominational group. And boy, if anybody's got $10,000, we need it for medicine. The group is mostly Catholic, by the way. They have more time. Because there are a lot of poor people that can't get any medical, and we gave them prescriptions, and they haven't given anybody to get the medicine. So we've got to get the medicine for them now. But you see, and I began to speak to black groups. I've been haunted by this problem of the poor, and I've never been able to care. I'm still trying to find a way to find my place in it. All because a man shared with us the struggle of his inner journey against a lifelong prejudice. And we watched him, alone and afraid and wonderful, as he climbed in the wheelbarrow for Jesus Christ and for some black men and women and little children who will never know.